All right, welcome back for another edition of our new series that is very, in my opinion, very cleverly named, right? We were digging deep. Funny. Pun intended. The deep dive segment with a friend of the show that we've had on several times. And wanted to have him back on because there's some stuff happening really interesting or that's really interesting to me that we've been talking about that he's been pounding the table on. And we wanted to get some updates. So without further ado, Mr. Cuppy, how you doing, pal?
Doing great. Thanks for having me back.
Hey, man. Good to have you back on. And this is kind of our gloves off segment. So we've all, you know, we just so you know, when we started the show, the goal was to kind of, you know, attack things that dig deeper than you're going to typically see on the CNBC headlines, but break them down so the average investor, you know, can understand what's going on, right? Bust out some of the vernacular, make it more edible. And then we had a lot of people asking for us to, if, you know, we could do like a gloves off segment, if we could just, you know, go deep and not try to break things down. So we've done two of these, and you were on the top of my list to have on, so we could dig deep into this stuff and not feel like we had to, you know, constantly explain things and translate things for the folks. So this is kind of more for the super nerds, the super finance geeks, of which I'm sure you and I both probably consider ourselves as being. But before we get into the market stuff, man, I have to talk to you about something that's kind of unmarket related, and I do not want to get into the political side. So don't think I'm wading you into a political issue here. But I know you're a guy that's very pragmatic, right? How do you like that for that warm up, right? It's like I'm walking you into a firing line. Just something that was really interesting, and I'm sure you agree, but in my experience, politicians don't do anything unless it's got an ounce of political gain in it for them. One of the curious things I think about the mandate, and I don't want to get into the efficacy of the mandate. This is not a political show, but just your political read on things. I think the timing of it, Cuppy, is really odd to me from a pure political standpoint, meaning, you know, based on people that have already had COVID and the number of people that have been vaccinated, estimates are somewhere between 85-90%, right? That covers, like, if you've had COVID or you've been vaccinated, it's like 85-90% of the population. That's herd immunity. The question I have is, why would you push something as controversial as a vaccine when you just hit herd immunity? And what I mean by that is, again, on the political side, it seems like a concave political move. You know what I mean? Where politically you only have downside to that. And that political side of it, trying to read through the political calculus, has just left me scratching my head. I don't get it, man. Do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, I don't really get it. I don't know if it's 85-90%, whatever you said. I think it's maybe a little lower, but I don't know why they're going to be going around bullying people to get a vaccine. You know, clearly they see stuff that we don't see and they know stuff we don't know. But, you know, when you go around and take people's jobs away and you know, don't let people into restaurants and bars and grocery stores and airplanes, I mean, it's pretty weird. I think they're trying to get rid of the control group just because they kind of know the vaccines don't work. You know, what we've seen is that, you know, they kind of wear off after a bit. And, you know, the question in my mind, and I'm sure I'm going out on some you know, shaky ground here. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. I'm a history major. But, you know, if the vaccines wear off, and the question really is, you know, is there a benefit of having something that protects you for a few months and then wears off? And, you know, so they're going for the third dose and the fourth dose because they want to keep everyone with these really active antibodies. The question is, if you let the thing wear off, are you worse off?
Right.
Than if you had never taken it before? And I guess my theory is that they kind of know something and, you know, they have data we don't have. And their real worry is that it actually has harmed people. You know, we know a lot of people have strokes in the first week or two after the vaccine. But, you know, I think what people... what people don't really know is, you know, big cohort data. What happens if you take two shots and then you don't have another booster? Are you worse off than the people who never had it or who had natural immunity? And if it turns out the government really screwed up, you know, I think they'd be scrambling because, you know, that's how you play defense.
Yeah,
but this is all conspiracy, tinfoil hatty sort of stuff. And
It is. And that's
like I said, I'm not a scientist.
No, and I'm not either. And that's why I was saying, to me, it's not even a political question. It's sitting back, looking at that decision this late in the game when you're just on the verge, or again, depends on whose numbers are, you're basically at the herd immunity numbers. And I just, it's odd to me, because usually you can look through what politicians do, right? And the true intent or the benefit to them is usually pretty evident. I'm looking at this one just going, this is strange to me. I don't see how you win from this. I don't think the mandate delivers any real benefit at this point. I think the vaccine potentially does, but like you said, there's a lot of unanswered questions there. The political side of it was just interesting to me, because you're like, man, you know, pushing the vaccine this late and pushing the mandate, I feel like, especially for the politicians on the left, it's only going to lose them votes. It was just a head scratcher, just going, that was odd. Anyway, I you know, not trying to make a statement one way or the other. I knew that you and I could have a rational conversation about it, and that seems to be the one thing you can't do these days, right? You can't have a rational, fact-based conversation.
No, you'll get kicked out of Twitter for that. And look, like I said, look, I'm not a doctor. I think everyone is adult enough to look at a lot of data, which is very buggy data, which has been manipulated. You know, there's no clean data left, which is something that people like me actually specialize in. You know, you look at economic data, it's all been manipulated. Either, you know, corporations give you the best data, or governments, you know, adjust it hedonically. I'm pretty good at looking at data and looking at, you know, irregularities and trying to understand what it all means. And this is, you know, extra hard because the data has really been played with a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, just the fact that they're playing with the data makes me super suspicious, because if the data was really good, they wouldn't play with it.
Right.
But in any case, you know, I'm not a doctor here, and I want to make that clear. And I'm definitely not anti-vaccine. I've you know, had my tetanus and, you know, my polio and all the others. This is the one that I'm a little skeptical of.
Yeah, and I get, like, that's the other thing, is people like, oh, you're some anti-vaxxer ape. And I'm like, what? You know, guys, when in the past has it been seen as being, you know, outside the mainstream because you wanted to see some time? You know, you wanted to see some proof of work, right? It's bizarre to me that wanting to sit back and see how it plays out is seen as like endangering society. You know, you're just... Anyway, we've danced.
Go ahead. Let me dance one last time, and let's talk about markets. I think anyone who thinks this is anything other than a phase one clinical trial is deceiving themselves. You know, phase one is safety, phase two is efficacy, and then phase three, you take it to a much larger sample size and see how it plays out. This is all done in a double-blind test. You have stated end goals. I mean, there's a pretty rigorous procedure that's been in place for a very long time, which has made American medicine successful. You know, internationally, it's pretty similar. And it's really odd that the goalposts keep moving. There is no safety data. The safety data is hidden. It's a phase one clinical trial with a few billion people in it. And it's really quite bizarre, the whole thing.
Well,
I think people in governments are scrambling because they have better data and the data is not good.
My wife got the vaccine about a week and a half ago, and she came home with the pamphlet. Her and I are going on a trip. I've got to get it. Probably getting it this weekend, actually. And I wanted to wait longer, but we timing issues, and I can't not make this trip. Anyway, she came back, and the lady that was giving her the super nice young nurse, giving her the vaccine, was telling her repeatedly that it's FDA approved. And that's what everybody around there is saying. And my whole thing is, I go, guys, I'm not being a conspiracy theorist here. I want to explain to you how FDA trials work. This is EUA approved. It's emergency use authorized. It has not gone through the three FDA trials, right? The three stages. It has not. There's not enough time for it, right? Yes, it's FDA approved in the EUA sense, the emergency use authorization. But that's a completely different ballgame than traditional FDA approval, is it not?
Yeah, and, you know, they have less clear data, and they're basically trying to, you know, solve for a problem that's a grave problem. That's why you have these sort of situations. You know, here's a, you know, disease that you're going to have, I mean, at least at my age group, like a 99.95 survival from. You know, it doesn't seem like it's necessary. Clearly, you know, if you're 70 or 80, you know, your odds are different. If you have, you know, comorbidities, if you're fat, like there's people who are at serious risk here, and this is probably, you know, helpful. It probably improves their odds.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the whole, you know, clinical trial is designed wrong. You know, of course, survivability goes up if you, you know, have your test on people my age. Anyway, let's go talk about stocks.
Yeah, there you go. I know. It makes me nervous. I feel like I'm walking around on glass because you just don't even know if someone's going to flip out. All right. So before we get into it, one of the things I was thinking about having our conversation, man, and one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is risk management. And the reason I wanted to talk to you about it is because you have had so many great picks. And I know that you have, I've seen you talk about it openly. You really have an iron stomach when it comes to volatility. How do you manage that? How do you stay on the horse when that thing, I mean, I just, you know, I manage retirement money, so the angle of everything we look at is different. You know, I'm always looking to manage the risk and suppress volatility as much as humanly possible. And yet I know that by doing that, and I explain this to our clients, by doing that, we're going to give out on some upside, right? The flip side of that is the way that you deal with that. And I mean that in a complimentary way. How do you deal with that level of vol? And then how do you look at risk management? Because I know you're not some half-cocked investor. I know that you allow higher levels of vol and you're used to it managing it. But I'm sure you've got risk management practices as well. Just kind of walk us through how you handle that side of the game.
So, you know, the first point, obviously, is that volatility has nothing to do with risk. Volatility is just random motion day to day in your portfolio, week to week. It's just part of having a portfolio that's more concentrated. You know, the way I think of risk is, am I going to have a permanent loss of capital because I made an analytical mistake? And sometimes you have a permanent loss of capital because you're just unlucky. But am I going to have a permanent loss of capital here? And so I'm looking at this and saying, how cheap is this asset? What do I really know about it? What can go wrong? And that's what I think about all day. I don't think about the share price. I mean, that's kind of random. I'm just thinking to myself, what could I go wrong? What do I not yet know? How can I get screwed here? And so, you know, securities, they go up, they go down. I don't really think of it that way. You know, when it goes up, I ask myself, you know, has this thing played out or is there more to play out? Is this, would I be a buyer here or a seller? You know, the famous quote is, if you're not a buyer, you're a seller. You know, you can't be a nothing. And so, you know, that's how I think about the world. And it's going to go up, it's going to go down. I mean, I tend to play in sectors that are inherently volatile. It's all partly what drives me to them. You know, when sectors had bad luck for a long time and it's burned a lot of people on the recovery, and I do a lot of inflection investing on the recovery, you know, every data point is going to be, you know, an action point for investors. If the data is good, the stock's going to go up 20 or 30%. If the data point's bad, it's going to go down 20 or 30%. Because everyone remembers that the last, you know, bear market, you know, they lost 90% owning this thing. But at the same time, everyone remembers that, you know, if it's turning, there's, you know, a couple 100% upside. You know, look at, you know, commodity names. Just the move in nat gas from 2 to 3, it was wavy and volatile and crazy. And then from 3 to 4 and then 4 to 5. Because everyone remembers that for a decade, everyone lost money in nat gas. And so, you know, you have to have a structural view and just kind of ignore it. But you have to question your view every day.
Yeah, no. So in your process then, do technicals play a role at all in what you do? Are you watching that? Or are you really coming at it hard from just the value fundamental side?
I'm just from the value fundamental side. I mean, when I get my entry, I like to time it a little bit with fundamentals. You know, I mean, as our fund's grown, obviously we need to have a position. So, you know, you don't want to be the one moving the stock. So you need to, you know, think a little bit ahead of where the stock chart is. But for the most part, you know, I'm looking to buy stuff that has stopped making new lows. If it's still making new lows, that's the market's way of telling you that people have zero faith that things are turning. Usually it makes a big bottom over a couple quarters, a couple years. And you know, as it starts showing a little bit of strength, it starts breaking out to 1, 2, 3 year highs. That's usually the market's way of telling you that they agree with you that things are getting better. And that's usually when I get really excited. I'll sometimes buy, you know, in the base, you know, but I want to buy strength. I want to buy it coming out of the base. I want to buy it when things are getting better, both at the corporate level and, you know, fundamental level, but also in terms of a stock chart. But for me, the number one driver to me is getting the corporate level right. You know, some, you know, if it's something very, you know, easy, like, oh, it's a commodity company and you see the price of the commodity going up, well, that's going to drive, you know, it's going to almost drag the stock up. But if it's something that's harder to track, it's more about, hey, I have data points saying things are getting better and the market hasn't figured it out yet, then, you know, we'll try to front run the market a little there.
It cracked me up because I think I'd heard you say this, but I was responding to a tweet the other day, and I was telling these guys that in my experience, the best, biggest wins, you know, 8, 10X type wins over compressed periods of time, you know, less than a year or over a year, have always come from things that looked like they were on the verge of insolvency that got to like, okay, now it's not so bad, right? Like that. And you had a, you and I didn't, and I may have heard you say this at one point, but I started laughing because somebody else quoted you and said, what is your saying about that, that the most money's made from when something goes from really bad to not so bad? Or what was that quote?
My quote is, the most money in finance is made when something goes from hopelessly fucked to sort of shitty.
No, hey, that is so true. And I just started dying laughing because I was like, man, I hadn't heard that quote, or maybe I had, but I was like, that is just so dead on the money. So to that note, the first thing I wanted to get in, man, is uranium. And you and I were tweeting back and forth about a week and a half ago. It was hilarious because you and Tony Greer did a segment on Real Vision talking about uranium and how URNM was going to kind of change the landscape, and you thought uranium was going a lot higher. Literally the next day, I think the entire complex was up like 10%, something like that, right? URNM was up like 13%. And I was just laughing because I was like, those suckers, that perfect timing. Like, you know, that was awesome. What do you see here? I wanted to run something by. We've been in the uranium trade. I don't want to say we bottom ticked it, but we got into Cameco like right at, you know, like 9 a share. We got into NXE at like Next Gen Energy at like $1.80. So we got in pretty early in the move, and we're sitting on some really nice gains. And one of the things that I am concerned about, and I know you've done a ton of research on this, is, you know, in these infrastructure bills, to me it is clear that the demand for uranium is going to go higher. You know, in the near future, if people are serious about green energy, and I know you and I think simpatico on this, the nuclear has to be a core part of it. They need to build more reactors. They're floating around the ideas of building smaller reactors. But those reactors are going to take time to come online. Where is that natural demand going to come from in the next 2 to 3, right? Because, I would imagine those reactors have got to take several years to get built and permitted, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially in the U.S., that's like 20 years.
Holy smokes. So that's what I'm saying. So where do we see, we know uranium is unsustainably cheap right now, just on an industry level, but where do we see that increased demand coming from?
I think it's coming from lots of places. I mean, just to start with, you know, most of the growth of nuclear, it's not happening in the U.S. It's happening, you know, in China and India. They have serious pollution problems, and they know they need nuclear. It's the only base load that's going to be viable for them, cost effective. And, you know, they're not so concerned about the CO2 emissions, but they're, you know, concerned if you have, you know, coal-fired plants, it's just black soot all over the place. You know,
right.
They're at, you know, level one pollution worries. You know, I think the next place they're going to come from is existing reactors that stay on. You know, Illinois just found a way to keep 2 more reactors going. Almost every month we learn of another reactor that's, you know, it's going to be postponed when it shuts down. I think you're going to see some restarts in Europe. I think you're going to see some restarts in Japan. You know, they can't be very happy with what they're paying with on LNG right here. You know, they're just getting squeezed. You know, nuclear is the cheaper solution for them. I think you're going to see that. I mean, so that's a lot of, you know, incremental demand. I mean, of course, the world is using 30 million pounds a year more than they produce. And so that's drawing down inventories. That's, you know, serious, you know, destockpiling. And then finally, you have this Sprott entity that's gone out there like a madman. It's bought more than 10 million pounds already in the first month it's been out there. And, you know, it's not going to buy every day. That's not how the vehicle works. That's to trade at a premium to spot. But I think over time, it'll continue to just go Pac-Man the uranium, and it'll just keep buying it all up. And once that uranium ends up in the vehicle, it's not coming back out. And so, you know, Sprott, it's not going to be, you know, 12 times 10 million pounds. That's crazy. But, you know, they might do a couple million a month, and that's real demand added to, you know, everything else. So I think over time, you're just going to squeeze the above ground stockpiles. You're going to, increase the price because, you know, if you have a nuclear power plant, you don't have any uranium, it's kind of a paperweight. And so these guys are going to, you know, have to pay the market price. And remember, the price of uranium is really negligible to the operating of a nuclear power plant. So they're just going to go out and pay the market price. And if the market price is higher, they're going to go pay that price. And, if Sprott ends up buying enough pounds that there's no more physical, they're going to go and, you know, outbid the other power plants because they really need uranium. And so I think this is just going to play out over time.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing for me is I look at it and I go, it really seems to me like it's the beginning of a long bull in that cycle, just when you look at the natural setup of it. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think I want to, you know, just mention, you know, this Sprott entity, you know, I bought all mine at 11, you know, like I said, I'm an inflection investor. Uranium had been between 25 and 30 for a bunch of years, and it kind of poked its head over 30, and I bought as much as I could. My reference price was about 31. But, you know, I was watching this closely. I have been watching the situation closely. And obviously, Sprott is the catalyst to change the value. A few weeks later, you know, all of, finance was super excited about the next big squeeze. And, you know, the Sprott entity went to 18 bucks from 11. And, you know, physical went above 50 from 30. And, you know, we're talking about a global commodity that's not a very liquid global commodity, but it was up 70% in a month. That's not normal.
No.
And so, of course, you know, when the price goes up, there's warehouses that have it. They have people that have owned this for years, hoping for a better price to sell some inventory, and some sellers showed up, and it's just very natural. And, you know, suddenly the price is backed off. I'm speaking right now, it's in the mid 14s, and, you know, so it's backed off by about a quarter, and this is just healthy and normal for a market. You know, it's funny, everyone was super excited about uranium 2 weeks ago, all weekend long, everyone was yelling about it, and here we are now, and everyone hates it, it trades below NAV.
Right.
You know, people get so bipolar, and they expect a two-three-year trade to play out in a week, and that's just not how this works.
So on your side of it, I think we're very much in the same camp as far as I love the long-term setup and the long-term story. And the way that I want to get in how you structure the trade a little bit. The way that I play situations like this is I get a core position that I believe in, and I'll buy on pullbacks. And then when it's running, I'll slap on other extra exposure, right? And if on a technical basis, if I feel like the run has stopped, I'll pull back on that extra exposure and just stick with my core position. How do you trade a position like this?
Well, I don't trade a position like this. I put it on and I wait for the trade to play out. You know, like I said, I caught the inflection. I've heard about this thesis for many years. I had a position in the fall of 2019. And the great thing about having like low beta longs in your book is that when the world ended in Q1 19 because of COVID, Q1 20, my uranium, you know, it dropped a little, but it didn't drop anywhere near as the other stuff I owned, and it didn't drop anywhere near what the rest of the market, especially small cap, did. And so I took a small little loss and reallocated the money into stuff that was down 90% that I thought was more attractive. And you know, I came back to this now because those things kind of played themselves out.
Do you have a range where you'll, you know, I'm assuming you don't have, like, my assumption would be you do not have max exposure to the sector right now that you would add on dips, correct?
Oh, no. I mean, I have a max position.
Okay, so you're just long and strong.
Yeah, everything I do is about putting as much capital to play as soon as I'm convinced the trade is working and as soon as I'm convinced it's got legs. And I just want to put it on as soon as it goes. I mean, with inflection investing, you usually get escape velocity, just like with this, you know. The price went up 70% in 2 weeks. Like, as people realize that something's changed in the trend, you know, there's a lot of smart people in the world. They're all going to jump on this as well. And a bunch of them are going to wait for the pullback that never happens. So you just got to put as much capital to work as fast as you can.
Gotcha.
And then from there, you got to suffer through the pullbacks.
Yeah.
And you really will suffer. There's going to be some nasty pullbacks.
Yeah, that's the tough part about it. And that's why I was having a conversation with one of my clients yesterday. And he said he was kind of asking about taking more of that type of a stance and asking me what my thoughts were. And I said, look, you know, when done correctly, concentrated investing, it makes the most money when done correctly. There's no question about it. But at the same time, if you don't have the gravitas and the stomach lining to be able to sit there and watch those drawdowns, which, you know, I don't know how you handle it, but I think we get more immune to them as professional investors. At the same time, when your P&L is down 25 or 30%, nobody's happy about it, right? It's not fun. It's not comfortable. And that's kind of what I was telling the client was, if you can't stomach the other side of it, then it's not a good strategy for you because you're going to end up getting chopped to death, right? You'll bow right out right at the bottom. You'll miss the run up. I mean, it's going to be a mess.
I mean, look at what's happening right now. Okay. Sprott went from 11 where I got in, it peaked out over 18. Here we are today in the mid 14s. I mean, I'm up over 30% on my pretty damn big position. I'm sitting pretty. I'm real happy. And, you know, people are emailing me, Cuppy, what are you doing? I mean, what am I doing? I'm talking with you, you know, like, what do they expect me to do? You know, it's not below my cost basis at 11. And so I'm not going to add anymore. And, you know, it's doing exactly what I expected to do. Really normal, yet all over, you know, the internet, I see people all bailing and they're saying, you know, uranium sucks and they're all pissed off. And I mean, yeah, if you buy something that's up 70% in 2 weeks, you're a moron. And if you're, you know, buying a position without the view that it's going to pull back, you're a moron. Like, I mean, you can see how volatile this thing is going to be. But inflections will be super volatile. Right now, everyone's panicked because it's below NAV. And everyone remembers when Grayscale went below NAV, the whole thing detonated. And then, you know, a couple of weeks or a month or two from now, everyone's going to be super excited because they're, you know, stacking pounds again. And, you know, they're going to get, you know, lopsided the other direction. I'm always amazed, actually, because in this inflection investing stuff, since I've done the same thing for a long time, I'm just used to this. But I've seen people that you walk them through the thesis, and over a 2 or 3 year period, they'll find a way to make no money at it.
Right.
Yet, you know, the underlying goes up, you know, 5-10 times. I mean, look at Bitcoin. Like, I told people to, you know, what my thesis was at 9,200 with Grayscale buying it all. And I had friends who literally, they buy, you know, the Bitcoin by the Grayscale, and they'd make, you know, 5-10%, then they'd lose 5-10%, they make 5-10%. I mean, it was a five bagger in 6-9 months, and
yeah,
somehow these people lost money. I just don't understand it. And they're like, oh, Cuppy, the chart's no good. And it's like, yeah, do you think this thing trades on a chart? Like,
right.
You know, Bitcoin's up 5,000 every morning. I wake up in the morning and it's either up or down 5,000. And,
yeah,
you know, I have 15 text messages, Cuppy, what's going on? It's like, I don't know. That's what Bitcoin does.
It reminds me. I got to tell you this one. I got to interject here. It reminds me of, and I know he's probably going to hear this. And so I'm not picking on him at all. But the guy that runs my operations, my first employee we ever hired, great, great guy. He's like my right-hand man. I probably couldn't even run the place without him. Anyway, he's kind of gotten into trading volatility. And I warned him against it. But anyway, and he pulled up the chart of the VIX, and he's like, look at the chart. And I looked at him, I go, buddy, you don't look at a chart on the VIX, right? This is implied volatility. I mean, you're better off looking at the chart of the S&P. And it kind of reminds me, you know, like you were saying, you get something that's moving up that much. Don't give me a classic technical equity chart, right? It's not at all following that pattern. I mean, for God's sakes, like you said, look at Bitcoin. I mean, things like a Super Bowl bouncing around.
Right. And so, you know, with uranium, it's going to be super volatile. Look, it doesn't, I mean, you have this thing, this Sprott entity that, you know, is a bunch of day traders trading it, and that's being priced roughly off the price of physical, which until Sprott showed up, it didn't even trade every day.
Right.
You know, and the bid-ask spread is probably $2 wide, and, you know, it's just, it's kind of an artificial construct. Either you think that the price is going much higher or you don't. And, you know, the day-to-day stuff means nothing to me. And then, of course, you know, the equities have a few times the volatility of what the underlying does. You know, and I don't have much exposure to the equities outside of Kazatomprom. You know, that's like the real producer. That's the one that's going to win. I actually think most of the juniors, you know, they're going to go from $1 to $5 back to 25 cents, and there'll be like 10 times more shares outstanding. You know, that's not my trade. But there's people who probably will make a lot of money at that. It's just not for me. One thing I want to point out is that when I do inflection investing, I'm really focused on my downside risk. So if I own Kazatomprom, you know, it's clean balance sheet, low cost producer. If I get it totally wrong, I'm not going to lose that much because, you know, I bought it at a price when it reflected no upside to uranium. You know, when I buy physical, I'm buying it at half the marginal cost to produce the thing. You know, there's not that much downside. Even when, you know, inventory was 100 million higher, this thing was trading at 30. Like, I bought it at 30. You know, but if you're buying some junior and they're drilling holes and they have to raise money every 6 months, like, you could have a donut on this if they can't raise more capital. You know, $1 stocks oftentimes, you know, issue $10 million of stock at 10 cents. Like, I see it all the time. Like, you can get wiped out. And I mean, people say, oh, I'll just play it really small. Well, if you're playing it small, it's not going to move the needle. So why play it? And you know, that's kind of my approach to this stuff. I don't want to take a lot of risk. I don't mind it being super volatile, but I don't want to take a lot of risk.
Yeah. Well, I think we've all experienced that. And I've talked about that many times to our guys, which is the worst thing in the world is to get the call right and then play it wrong. You know, where uranium goes up, you know, 8-9 times, whatever it is, whatever it ends up being, you get that call right. You invested for the right principles, but you bet on the wrong horse. You know, that's it. It's like the worst. I've been there before. It's like, it's just awful, right? Got to avoid that misstep.
Right. And in a commodity producer, I've always found actually just buying the physical commodity is often the better trade. I mean, people think there's actual leverage to the price of uranium at the juniors, but I mean, a lot of these juniors trade as if the mine is already built, whatever mine they intend to build, it's already built, and, you know, uranium's at 100. Like, that's where these things are priced at. And there's a lot of steps along the way that'll get totally screwed up, and they're going to dilute you, and it's going to go over budget, and probably the mine never even gets built. So you get really no leverage. It's just like a greater fool theory. And, you know, a younger version of me would buy all the 50-cent stocks. And, you know, I guess more mature version of me just buys the physical and, you know, kind of ignores it. It's what gives you the flexibility to ignore the volatility. I mean, if I owned, 50-cent stock that went to $1 and it's now 60 cents, I'd be worried all weekend, like, did I get it wrong? Are they going to do a down round? Are they going to screw me? Is the thesis over? Like, I'd be freaked out because you're really buying like super high torque directional uranium. And that's a lot scarier than just owning the uranium itself.
No, that's an interesting point. And
that's why you get shaken out.
Yeah, right. And I hadn't really applied that thinking to the uranium market, but you bring up a great point, which is the real bull story is not around any one of these companies. The real bull story is around uranium, right? And the price of uranium literally has to go higher. There's not going to be any left. Right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. But I think also what people really miss is that Kazatomprom, they're the low-cost producer. They're using ISL, which is like a two-year turnaround time. They have huge deposits of this stuff. They don't have the permitting headaches that you have. I mean, it's Kazakhstan. They just kind of go ahead. I think, you know, they're going to just increase production over time. I think MacArthur River may or may not come back online in my lifetime. I'd say it's a toss-up. They might threaten it, but I don't know if it actually will. You know, I don't know if Paladin ever comes online in my lifetime. I would guess that, you know, Uzbek and Kazakh ISL floods the market again at a higher price. You know, they're like OPEC. They're going to, you know, play their hand out to make the most possible money. And I think that's where, you know, people's focus should be. I don't think any of these other mines really come online. If you add in MacArthur River, you know, Paladin, Lotus, and, you know, maybe, you know, one or two other Cameco assets or, you know, whatever the Kazakhs have. I mean, you have enough uranium. I mean, there'll be a surplus again. So any of these other assets that haven't been built yet, there's no functional reason for them to ever be built. They're just speculative toys.
Okay.
And I think people miss that point. I mean, of course, you know, what we've learned in the last couple of years is that worthless assets can go to crazy prices. And I don't want to ever, you know, stop someone from speculating. But, you know, my clients want me to do intelligent things, and we're not here to gamble. We're here to make money.
No, I hear you. I hear you. What about now? One thing I have not spoken to you about, another little very interesting area to me, is I'm still hip deep in the energy trade. We've taken some profit on it because we got the timing perfect. And whenever you get the timing perfect, I've learned a long time ago not to think it's because you're brilliant. You know, we were watching it. You know how it is. I mean, we were watching it. We did it the right way. But you just don't typically bottom tick things like that. So we took a little profit. I'm reading a lot. I wanted to get your take on the cold winter thesis and the current and potential supply constraints as it relates to nat gas, coal, all these. What is your take on nat gas, coal, oil? Are you still bulled up on energy? Are you still in that trade, loving it? Where are you at on that?
So I think it's going to overshoot something stupid. You know, I've pulled back a bit on the nat gas side. I made a ton of money. I caught the absolute bottom. I mean, I ten Bankard Sandridge. You know, it's enough.
I can vouch for that. You were pounding on the table when that thing was. Didn't it have a one handle on it when you were pounding on it?
Sure did. Now it's 12.
Yep.
And you know, it traded for half a cash and was profitable. You don't get too many of those in your career, and you bought a few percent of the company.
Yeah,
but. I mean, it was one of those where I'm a generalist, and sometimes, well, I usually know I know nothing about geology, but I couldn't figure out how to kill the thesis. And so I would have actually played it bigger even, except for the fact that I don't know anything about geology, and I figured all the smart guys knew more than me, and apparently they didn't.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look at nat gas right now, you know, it's trading with a five handle, and, you know, the marginal cost to produce it is something with a two handle. And so... you know, it trades at twice the cost of producing it. I like to look at commodities that trade, you know, dramatically below the cost of producing them with a logical reason why they should go above the cost of producing them. You know, I could see a cold winter and seeing nat gas go to some horrifying, you know, number. You know, just look what's happening in the UK. And look, I have some exposure there still. I just cut it back because I don't want to be too greedy. But no, I think oil is about to do something absolutely insane. You know, every day I hear of a different politician going out there doing something to an oil company, and these oil companies are just being beaten over the head. You know, first it's their own shareholders who don't want them making money. Look at Exxon, where they got hijacked by activists who told them to stop making money. And then,
right.
You know, you had courts that told Shell they have to get out of the energy business, which is kind of ludicrous. And then, you know, pipelines get canceled and permits get pulled. And I mean, one of the reasons I think oil goes some crazy number is because it's too damn hard to produce it suddenly. And, you know, I don't really want to own the energy companies because I think they're just going to get brutalized. You know, there's going to be carbon taxes and there's going to be, you know, extraction taxes. And they're going to be the punching bag for all sorts of politicians, much like, you know, gold mining stocks were last cycle. Instead, I just want to own the physical because I think people have it in their heads that EVs are the future and, you know, global oil demand is about to collapse. And, you know, I think they're probably going to be right. They're just like 10 years early.
And, yeah, and they're, you know, compressing the curve, right? I mean, they're compressing
exactly.
The curve.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're basically trying to reduce the supply because even a lot of the oil companies think that we've hit peak oil demand. I don't think we peak out for another decade at least, and we might peak at 120, you know? And, you know, meanwhile, we're building, you know, a lot of... So, yeah, you have this, like, fast cycle, you know, shale stuff, and that ramps up, that ramps down, okay? But most of the world's oil comes from long cycle projects that sometimes take 5 and 10 years to build. And if you don't start building those and you put all the reliance on OPEC, which is probably lying about how much capacity they have, and you put it on shale where U.S. government's not going to allow them to ramp up, I mean, where is the future oil going to come from? And so, you know, you have this decline curve of a bunch of, large assets owned by governments and IOCs, and these things are in permanent decline and they're not spending more money. I think oil is going to do something stupid. And going back to my last comments about, I don't play junior oil stocks. I don't play junior, uranium stocks. I mostly own physical, futures in oil. I own the 2025 futures. I own future call options. I own call spreads. I mean, I'm just playing the physical. I tend to think the physical overshoots, and a lot of oil companies don't make any money, and the money they are allowed to keep after taxes and everything is probably just going to go back in the ground and be wasted eventually. I mean, I don't think it's going to show up in shareholders' pockets. That's the history of oil companies. So, no, I don't want to own the producers. I want to own just futures, and I want to go far out on the curve. I want inflation working for me.
Switching over, just a random question. Do you feel differently about gold miners than gold? Like, in terms of, if you think you're going to get a big run in the price of gold, do you have the same approach where you want to own the underlying and not the producers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the last thing I want to own is a gold mine.
See, I've made piles on gold miners.
Okay, well, look, gold miners are, I think they're more different in a way than oil. I mean, oil, especially large basins, you kind of know what you're going to get. Each well is going to sort of match.
Right.
You kind of know what you're getting,
right?
And so you have discoveries, and there's some huge winners from discoveries, but a lot of it is just basic production. It's return on capital calculations and cost curves and stuff. With gold mining, each asset's very, very different.
Totally.
And this huge dispersion of returns. And there's some people in the gold sector that just consistently make money. I'm not one of them. I've tried. I suck at it. And, I started buying gold when it was trading at 300. This was 20 years ago. And,
yep.
The GDX came out in, I think it was 2006.
Yep.
And here we are. And gold was about 500 when GDX came out. And gold's about 1,800 right now. So it's more than tripled. And GDX is actually down.
Yeah.
I mean, it shows you how little leverage there actually is. And, some of this is, bad M&A and bad corporate decisions and blah, blah, blah. But, over a diversified basket of large mining companies, they've net destroyed a ton of value during a time when, gold more than tripled. Like, I don't want to own that thing. I just want to own gold.
Yeah. No, I get it. And that was one of the... And people really wouldn't believe it, too, until you're on the inside. And a lot of these companies supposedly have gotten religion. A lot of them have cleaned up their balance sheets. Things look better. But until you're there and you listen and you watch the way that these people allocate capital, by and large, and I'm talking, again, I have not been to a gold mining site in probably 7 or 8 years. So, and for obvious reasons, it's not exactly where the money's been made over that period of time. But these people, at least in that last cycle, when I was going around to a lot of different mine sites, these people their ability to incinerate capital is really stupendous. You walk around and you're just looking at things. And in my mind, I'm going, ching, ching, just adding up the costs of all the stuff I see that is complete, has nothing to do with the underlying value of the property or even the extraction of gold. They were money incinerating machines. I think that, you look at a company like Barrick. Barrick was probably one of the worst offenders. And if you don't believe me, once again, We had an operation in Colorado where we processed gold through Barrick's Gold Strike operation in Nevada. The inefficiencies, you'd have to see it to believe it. It's incredible. But it does look like Barrick. I think Barrick is somewhat emblematic of a lot of these different companies, Cuppy, because they have seemed to have gotten religion. They have tidied things up. But do you think that just lasts until the next breakout in gold and they start doing the same stuff again? Damn it. There you are. Can you hear me?
Yeah, here. Sorry, you cut out for a second. So I think Barrick, look, they're going to make some money. They've gotten some religion. They stopped just drilling holes in the middle of nowhere and lighting money on fire, which is usually what mining guys do.
I mean,
literally, they have a cash cow, and instead of paying a dividend, they want to poke holes. But, I mean, look at it. It's a spread business, and I don't like spread businesses, okay? They're going to earn a spread between the price of gold and their cost to produce gold. And they don't control really either side of the spread. The geology is already preordained. You know, they're going to get hit over, you know, over top by, you know, taxes and all sorts of other stuff that's out of their control from a political standpoint. A lot of these mines are in funny places. But in reality, you know, gold mining is just a dirt moving operation. Diesel is roughly a third of the total cost. I mean, we're talking about energy. Like, I don't think energy stopping at 74. I think oil, you know, it's about to totally moonshot. I think it's going to be a couple hundred. You know, I don't buy call options very much, and I bought a lot of call options. I think it's going to absolutely go bananas. Like, so you're going to have your, you know, 30-year cost going crazy. We already know labor is going crazy, especially skilled labor. Steel's going crazy. Equipment's going crazy. Like, all the costs that go into their, you know, cost structure going crazy. Meanwhile, you know, gold's kind of down. It just sounds like a terrible place to be. I know that people sometimes get excited and, you know, they don't think through the economics of a lot of these things. They just go, let's buy gold because of inflation, or let's go get leverage gold. But in the end, you have a business that has cash flows, and your cash flow is going to get squeezed unless the price of gold starts going up faster than the other costs. And what I saw last cycle, you know, and, you know, gold went from 300 to, you know, 1200, is that a lot of these other costs went up faster. I mean, oil went from 10 bucks to 150,
yep.
You know,
yep.
You know, labor was a multi-bagger, you know, steel was a multi-bagger. I mean, dumb things like mining, you know, tires, like, those things, yep, ended up going up like 20 times. And so these companies all got squeezed, and, you know, it didn't work like I expected it to. And having been through that rodeo once, I got a feeling it's going to sort of rhyme. I'd rather just own the physical, or if I have to own anything, I'd rather own something like Major Drilling, which is just going to poke holes because I know these guys well enough. They're going to take their cash flow and start drilling because everyone, I mean, look,
they have to, Cubby. I mean, that's the, right. That's them teasing the Cybertruck, right? They got to keep poking the holes because you got to keep extending out the story, right?
Right. Well, I mean, no one wants to buy a cash flow story at 7x cash flow. Like, this is not very excited.
Right.
So, no, you got to make the thing fun. You got to go. And besides, you know, these guys don't own a lot of stock. I mean, it's got to be a lot of fun to use someone else's money to go look for buried treasure. You know, like, it's got to be a lot of fun. You could tell all your buddies you found a deposit.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's good business.
You get a big
get
bonus if you find a deposit. And if you don't find, a deposit, no one really cares because you allocate a budget. And if you find something, you get a big bonus, and, you know, you get to spin it off and put your kid in charge of it. It's just like a lot of fun.
The other thing too, man, and you brought up, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but you brought up regulatory issues with the energy markets, right? And how they're up against Washington, D.C. Again, I am so sympathetic with the gold bulls. I'm cheering them on. I think gold is a must own in a portfolio these days. Having said that, the other side of it is the regulatory aspect. And my dad is still the CEO of a very small publicly traded gold mining operation in Colorado. And I do not think people have any understanding of how tyrannical the BLM has gotten and how they can just extort money from you at any period, at any given moment. They had a deal where they were trying to put a bunch of lime in. It was a drainage issue out of the mine for mine water for runoff. And BLM came in with us and co-engineered this whole thing. And so we spent, you know, probably $400,000 or $500,000 putting in this drainage system to their specs. They came down a year and a half later. They had the biggest rainfall in that area of the mountains in the last 90 years in that winter. They come out, test the soil right off the side of it, and they had a slightly higher rate of arsenic than normal or something like that. But when they tested the streams in the lake right below the mine, nothing, right? So the drainage, and it just overflowed the drainage that they approved. They stuck us with a $300,000 fine and said, look, you can fight us, but it'll cost you more in fees. Yeah, I don't think people realize that side of it either. The regulatory side, the BLM has, here in the States anyway, they've got these guys over a barrel and can pull capital out of them at a moment's notice.
Right, which is why I don't want to own the producers. I think, you know, oil's had it really good just because, you know, oil's a bigger industry, more lobbyists, blah, blah, blah. I think they're about to be the, you know, just like gold was kind of the victim last cycle, I think the oil guys are going to be, you know, this pinata that everyone kind of beats over the head for, you know, spare change. And I don't want to own those guys.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mind owning some of the guys selling, you know, lubricants and selling downhole equipment. And I mean, those guys are going to make a fortune.
The shovel sellers. Right, the shovel sellers.
Yeah, I don't mind owning those.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, Wall Street prices everything on the first and second derivative, okay? So last year, there was no spending at all in CapEx and energy. So the first derivative is going to be positive because this year they're spending more. And as oil goes higher, the second derivative is going to accelerate. It's going to be, you know, a great place to be. And, I mean, a lot of these things came out of bankruptcy, and I bought a bunch of equipment out of bankruptcy at 10 cents on the dollar. Like, it's hard to lose money unless you think no one's ever going to, you know, need any, you know, drilling equipment. You know, and a lot of these things are up a lot for me, but I think they're going to keep going. You know, I would say the one other thing I'm really excited about is offshore. I know everyone hates offshore. It's just been, you know, brutalized, and it's, you know, it's hurt people badly. You know, as it gets harder to operate in North America, it gets harder to operate in Europe, I think you're going to see more and more of the world's oil production come from places that don't have regulations.
That makes sense.
You know, I don't think anyone's looking to go onshore because, you know, you just take on too many risks and it's too visible. But I think guys are going to, because, I mean, if you're onshore, also the local guys can do it. Anyone can buy a drill rig. They're not that expensive and they can produce oil. So you're going to be competing with the local guys, which is usually not where you want to be. But offshore, they can't, you know, they can't compete with you because these, you know, you have this really specialized piece of equipment. You need, you know, hundreds of trained people. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars. And so I think you're going to have places like, you know, Guyana and Brazil and, you know, Angola and, you know, all of West Africa. They're going to basically say, hey, come produce our oil, you know, produce our oil, pay us some taxes. You can keep the rest of it. And I think a lot of this oil equipment that is still kind of mothballed is going to come back online. I think these are going to all be multi-baggers. You know, I own a ton of Valaris. It's one of my largest positions. I bought it right out of bankruptcy at $21. It hit a new all-time high today at about 34. So, you know, good for me. But I think it's got a lot more to play out, or I hope it does. But no, I mean, I like these sort of situations. You know, you buy some equipment at a fraction of what it costs to build with the view that it's going to have a future and it's not going to get scrapped. And, you know, I got it with a very clean balance sheet. So if I got it wrong or it took another year or two to play out, like there was no chance of me getting really hurt.
What do you see? What do you see on? I was just looking at Tesla up 2% on the day, and I don't want to get into a Tesla conversation, but it reminded me of. I just can't do it. I've beat my head against a wall too many times.
I can't either.
It's just one of my partner in crime that runs our momentum algorithm. Portfolio that's done exceptional. He finally just muted everything Tesla in his feed. He's like, I just can't take it anymore. And I was like, you know what? That is a wise decision. But I'm sitting here looking at rates creeping up, and the nice little pop in rates here over the last day or two. Where are we at right now? I think we have the 10-year at 1.45, 1.46, right as of right now. what do you think? To me, it looks like, and I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch, but to me, it looks like we might be looking at another pop higher in yields here. And I'm kind of getting excited because I think that the value in the commodity space, if that occurs, I think we should have another good rally in front of us. Talking about on the rate side, though, it looks to me like we've got a nice little pop here in rates. The 10-year is at 1.46. It looks to me like we're setting up for another run here in the end toward the value side of things, hopefully. And I, again, maybe it's me preaching my own book, the commodity side of things, the things that are inflationarily or inflationary sensitive. And I would also expect this rise in rates to give a smackdown to a lot of the Zimbabwe stocks. Do you agree with that? If not, how do you see it? And how do you think when you're looking out toward the end of this year, you know, and again, not trying to put you on the spot here, but do you agree with that thesis? You think we're going to see value and inflationary type assets rally into the end of the year and get a smackdown in some of the Zimbabwe type stocks, as you call them?
Rates are picking up. I see that, you know, the yield curve is flattening. I see that, you know, they're kind of giving two different messages here. And you know, I don't really know what matters anymore. The Fed controls the whole curve. It's hard to really say if it's indicative. I mean, I remember when the curve used to be a big fat curve that you could play with. Now, you know, 10 basis points means something because, you know, there's so little room to maneuver inside the curve. I don't really know. I think that commodities are about to go mental, though. I've been saying that for a while, and you know, the rate of change, the ascent of the slope keeps accelerating, and I think it's about to really, really accelerate. You know, I think people are about to realize, just like the UK, where nat gas went to infinity effectively, and they couldn't find any at any price until it got so high that it destroyed demand. I think you're going to see the same with a bunch of commodities. You know, there's been really no investment in commodities, and you have a little bit of a supply shock, and it goes crazy. And I think particularly oil, which is the granddaddy of them all, which leads pretty much everything because it goes into the cost structure of everything. You know, think about your gold mine. I think it's about to go mental. They stopped spending on oil a few years ago, and the demand is still accelerating. I mean, I think people really focus on the U.S. and, you know, EV and, oh, you know, nice Tesla, you know, nice this, nice that. And look, most of the world's energy growth is coming from China and India. And China is sort of in the middle of its S-curve. India is just embarking the S-curve. You know, LATAM and Africa are in their own stages of this, but you have a few billion people that are going to catch up to, you know, energy consumption of Americans. And, you know, it's going to happen very fast. And I think it's going to truly surprise people in terms of how much incremental demand is created, even if those people are driving Priuses instead of, you know, pickup trucks. And I just think this could be huge demand growth at a time when the supply is, you know, not being invested in. It's probably going to trail off the gallon. Like, I don't really care. I mean, if I have somewhere I need to go, I mean, I'm not going to walk.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, a lot of people are going to be in a similar boat, you know, $10 to fill up your Prius, but it lasts all a month. Like, they're just going to spend it. And so I just think the demand is going to surprise. And I think look, oil's hitting new, you know, multi-year highs right now. And, you know, you still have places locked down for COVID. I mean, imagine when these places start unlocking again. I mean, imagine what's going to happen. It's going to be, I mean, when people start really flying again, like, I think it's just going to overshoot dramatically. You know, when you see a market, and I've been doing this 20 years, when you see a market that starts making new highs on bad news, I mean, the bad news is a bunch of countries are locked down. The demand's artificial, you know, gasoline or energy. Texas had problems because they screwed it all up. UK has problems. All of Europe has problems. You start seeing these breakaway gaps on the demand where there's just no supply at any price. It's a warning that the system is getting much more fragile. And I think you're going to see it in crude oil.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm just wondering, and it might be futile on my part, but I'm just sitting here wondering how long the whole Zimbabwe stock craze is going to last. Not that it matters. We're not playing in the space, and I should probably just ignore it altogether for mental sanity reasons, mental health reasons. But do you see – I've heard people with very strong views make the argument that rates going up is going to be – is going to have a compressing – and it's a perfectly logical argument, but that's kind of what scares me about that argument as it relates to those Zimbabwe type stocks, the Teslas of the world, because you're making a large logical argument on a stock that is not behaving and priced logically at all. So there really is no guarantee that if the discounting rate or you know, the yield on the 10-year goes up, that those valuations don't necessarily have to get compressed, right?
Yeah, I mean, any stock can trade at any price. It's all arbitrary and kind of random to a certain sense, which is why I'm just giving up trying to guess.
Right, right.
You know, I feel very strongly, though, that, you know, a lot of the commodity sectors will go up. I think inflation's about to, you know, come in a big way. You know, high PE, you know, Ponzi sector sort of assets, you know, capital. If you look at, you know, my view of Project Zimbabwe is that the overall S&P, the market keeps going higher. It's going to be very, very volatile. But I think you're going to see rotations. And I think, you know, if you look at this historically, once a bubble bursts, it never really reignites. It's some new bubble that kind of carries. And so we had a bubble in EV and solar and, you know, fake, you know, green stuff. And that's kind of failing. And we still have something of a bubble in, you know, SaaS and social media, and, you know, that hasn't quite yet popped. And, you know, you have platform companies that have no profitability, no path to profitability, and those haven't really popped yet. But I think capital is going to incrementally cycle out of that. I mean, we had a bubble in fit currencies, you know, let's be realistic. You know, I think that's already popped. I think we're going to cycle out of that sort of stuff and into other stuff. And, you know, if you can guess where it cycles next, you can do very well. You know, my guess is it's probably energy, but I've guessed wrong many times in my career. My position's in a way that if I'm totally wrong, I probably don't lose much money. And if I'm right, I make multi-bagger.
Right.
That's the important part.
Right. No, that's the entire game. And that whole conundrum is one that I don't even know if conundrum would be the right word, but looking at that scenario with I guess the one thing that I fear is that I've watched over this cycle, I've watched underlying macro trends and I've watched fundamentals just get thrown out the window. And, it doesn't mean, you know, obviously that can't be sustained over the long run and the fundamentals always win out. But it does make you, you know, you're just in this bizarre environment where it seems like if you're doing the work, right? And I guess, you know, it's been much more true in the previous years because we've had a great run in value over the last 12 months. But if you're really doing the work and really looking for fundamentals, it's been a knock against you. It's been a hurdle that you've had to overcome where you can just jump in these nonsense cult-like stocks and just ride them to the moon. I personally, and again, I'm not playing it. I don't have a horse in the race, but I'm personally looking for, you know, really, really looking forward to the point where, you know, things get back to a more rational level. Is that kind of one of the arguments you're making, is that the inflation side of things, the supply shortages that I could be completely putting words in your mouth here, but it kind of seems to me like you're saying that the aftermath of COVID is almost going to bring the fundamental things back to the forefront for a variety of different reasons, and is going to make, you know, economic reality kind of unavoidable. Would that be fair to say that's kind of a convoluted way of saying it, but would that be a fair way to summarize part of your outlook?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with COVID is that it's destroying the supply side. It's destroying the ability of companies to add inventory. It's making labor hard to get. It's adding dysfunction in supply chains. It's overall highly inflationary. And I think as that trickles through, it's going to make a lot of these Ponzi sector companies difficult to manage too. It's going to make, you know, companies that actually get valued on cash flow, you know, it's going to make them difficult to manage and be profitable. I think, I don't know. I think it's going to filter through to lots and lots of places. And, you know, that's the reason why companies get lower multiples during inflation, because there's less, there's more volatility of the earnings because, you know, something breaks, something happens, something goes wrong, you know, there's an overrun on the cost side here, then there, and they can't get a piece of equipment they need. I just see that as being part of why inflation leads to, you know, lower stock prices or lower earnings multiples, you know, irregardless of the fact that, you know, interest rates go up usually. I just think it's going to make things very dysfunctional, and the government's going to probably stand there and make it all worse, as they always do.
they're coming to the rescue, right? They're going to smooth things out for us and make it all better. Okay, so outside of the energy side of things, anything else on your radar? Do you think that you've, you know, I'm not sure I've ever looked at a macro picture, man, that the energy side of it, all the things that we've covered, and again, just as a warning, this could be doom for your outlook, but those things seem sort of unavoidable. I'm with you on the oil side. I'm with you on the uranium side. On a more of a macro look, what do you think we're looking at going forward? Is it just going to be, do you think we're going to kind of return to the pre-COVID deal of slow growth, government's trying to stimulate it, getting a little pop, government's pulling back on the stimulus, growth falling off? Do you think we're getting right back to that, or do you think we're heading straight into an inflationary environment and then that's really going to dictate terms going forward?
Well, I think we're going to probably have a little bit of a pullback just because, you know, the Fed's talking about QT and raising rates, and you know, you see a bunch of other countries starting to raise rates, and it looks like, you know, the 3.5 stimulus is maybe not happening, and that means there probably won't be other stimulus, and we're kind of on a sugar high of stimulus right now, and it takes some time to go through the system. So, no, I'd expect a bit of a pullback, especially, you know, consumer stuff. That's, you know, where most of the stimulus money went. So, I think you're going to see some of a pullback there. I also think you're going to see, you know, an acceleration in the real economy as people get back to work and do things that need to get done. But, you know, the big picture, I think we're going to see a lot of inflation with a lot of government meddling. You know, it's probably going to look more like Argentina than, you know, traditional America. And it's going to be super dysfunctional. And, you know, we're going to be fighting germs, and we're going to be fighting, you know, pronouns, and we're going to be fighting, you know, carbon dioxide, and we're going to be fighting all sorts of things. I didn't know were the enemy. And it's just going to make it very difficult to operate a business, which, you know, I think for the last 18 months, people keep saying it's going to go back to normal, and maybe it won't. And I don't think people maybe accept that, which is kind of why, you know, I think you're going to see massive overshooting in various commodities because the demand is there, but they can't go back to normal on the supply side.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense, man. And while all this carnage is going on, I feel like you're going to be sitting down in front of a couple screens, splitting your time between a couple behind a couple of screens and sitting on the beach, sipping a Mai Tai down there in Puerto Rico. Huh?
You know, if it's always as easy as it has been, it'll be great. You know, it's never this easy. You know, it's been a good run, and I'm sure I'm about to get kicked. I'm about to get kicked in the nuts. But
that's always the way it goes, right?
In the end, if you find good trends and you get in, yeah. But if you find good trends and you get in at the inflection, and you don't do anything too stupid along the way, and you get out if the trend changes, you're probably going to do okay. That's the history of, you know, my career. And we're just going to keep doing what we've been doing, which is finding one or two good trends a year and riding the ones we have on the books already.
I love it, man. Well, okay, so just in case people don't know, which I'm sure we've got people listening to this that don't, where can the folks get a hold of you? You're at HCuppy on Twitter, right?
Right. And then Adventures in Capitalism. I have a blog. I write whenever I have something to say. You know, it's free, so you get what you pay for. And then if you want to subscribe, we have an event-driven monitor at KEDM.com. KEDM.com. It's a 4-week free trial. You know, please sign up. Check it out. We're tracking about 20 event-driven strategies. You know, I talked about finding Valaris out of bankruptcy. It was flagged in KEDM that it came out of bankruptcy. You know, it's being able to know exactly when something good is happening that you can start researching it before it starts running up. And so, you know, I've found just some amazing things out of KEDM, and you know, I hope you will as well.
I will. Well, we have, and that's why I was sitting there realizing that my membership had lapsed. So, no joke. I'm going to be a member again. And no, man, thank you. You've done some great research, and we made some good money on Valaris, and I got that idea from you. So I've got no. I always tell our guys, look, man, you don't have to come up with the winning idea. You got to find the guy that does. Right. So, no, man, it's been great. It's worth every penny. I can't recommend it enough. And keep flushing those fines out for us, man. Much appreciated.
Yeah, happy to. And, you know, we have a decent sized team now working for us. You know, we're flagging the opportunity, and it's up to you to go figure it out.
Yeah, we got to structure it. Well, hey, pal, thanks again for coming on, man. It's been great to catch up with you. Again, follow him on Twitter. Sign up for the newsletter at KEDM. I can't recommend it enough. And, Cuppy, best of luck to you, man. Enjoy things down there in PR, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Sorry the internet's not as good as it should be.
Hey, we'll get you back post-satellite dish. So we'll have you sounding like you're here in studio with us.
Great.
All right, pal. Take it easy. All right, you guys. Thank you so much for tuning in for another episode of our Deep Dive segments. Hopefully, you got as much out of it as I did. We will be back next week, as always. So don't forget to check out the podcast and download these Deep Dive segments. I'm having a blast doing them. Hope you're having a blast listening to them. We'll be back next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.